please stay tuned to the end of this program or see the show notes for important information regarding today's speakers and the content of this podcast. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Allergy Talk, a roundup of the latest in the field of allergy and immunology by the American College of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology. For today's episode, we will be reviewing three articles from the November-December 2022 issue of Allergy Watch, a bi-monthly publication which provides research summaries to college members from the major journals in allergy and immunology. And you can also earn CME credit by listening to this podcast for information or to read archived issues of Allergy Watch, head over to college.acaai.org/publications/AllergyWatch. And also make sure you check out the ACAAI community on Doc Matter, where we can continue the discussion about the articles today. Well, hello, my name is Jerry Lee. I'm an associate professor at Emory University. I'm an assistant editor of Allergy Watch. And once again, I'm joined by the editor-in-chief of Allergy Watch, Dr. Stan Feinman.
Hi, everybody, and thanks, Jerry. Great to be here. And as Jerry said, I'm the current editor-in-chief of Allergy Watch. I'm also an adjunct faculty member at Emory, and I'm in practice at Atlanta Allergy and Asthma.
And for our third chair, we are really excited to be joined by another Allergy Watch assistant editor, Dr. Shyam Joshi. Dr. Joshi, why don't you tell the listeners about yourself?
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. So I am an assistant professor of medicine at Oregon Health and Science University and the chief of allergy and immunology here, and very excited to talk about some articles today.
All right. Well, let's let her rip. So Stan, I think you're going to tell us about a potential new product or maybe not for practice. Why don't you tell us about it?
So this was an article published in New England Journal of Medicine, reviewed by Dr. Knox, and it's entitled Albuterol-Budesonide Fixed-Dose Combination Rescue Inhaler for Asthma, and it's called the Mandela Trial. It's a multinational phase 3 double-blind randomized event-driven trial. I'm not exactly sure how they got Mandela out of it, but that's what they call it. It included over 3,100 patients who had moderate to severe asthma with at least one severe exacerbation in the last year. So they had to either have a treatment with steroids for 3 days, an emergency room or urgent care visit, or an inpatient hospitalization in the 12 months prior to when they started to monitor these patients and enroll these patients, basically. Most of them were 12 or older. There were 97% were that old, although they did enroll some that were younger, down to 4 years of age. We'll talk about that in just a minute. And they were randomized 1:1:1 to receive 40 micrograms of budesonide, 90 micrograms of albuterol. And then the other was albuterol, 180 micrograms alone. The children who were 4 to 11, which there weren't very many, were assigned to the very lower dose. And the time to first severe exacerbation was evaluated by intention to treat. So that was really their primary efficacy endpoint, was the first event to severe exacerbation of asthma. There were some secondary endpoints as well, which we can talk about in just a minute. The patients who were 12 and older, they could analyze. The higher dose albuterol-budesonide combination was associated with a reduced risk of a severe exacerbations. In fact, they had a hazard ratio of 0.74, and that shows a reduction of the risk. With a lower dose combination, the hazard ratio was 0.84, so you had a better reduction with the higher dose than the lower dose. And then the annualized rate of severe exacerbations was 0.43 with a higher dose versus a 0.58 with albuterol alone, and the other dose was kind of in between. The bottom line was the study suggested that the higher dose of albuterol-budesonide combination used as a rescue inhaler can reduce severe exacerbations in adults 12 and older with moderate to severe asthma compared to albuterol alone. And these are findings consistent with previous findings combining inhaled steroids and other types of rescue medications. And Samantha Knox, who is one of our assistant editors, stated in her comment that this really adds to the mounting evidence supporting the use of inhaled steroids in combination with inhaled beta agonist, as it has been shown in the single maintenance and reliever study, the SMART study, which we're all familiar with. One of the problems with the study was that there weren't that many children, and so they really couldn't analyze the children part of it. But one of the strengths of the study is it was a large study and it was multiple sites. So I think they did set this up as to try to be a phase 3 study, and it did get approved. So maybe you could comment on that.
Stan, I would love your thoughts about this product, only because budesonide formoterol exists and it's generic. So do you think there's a place for an ICS-SABA in the world of ICS-formoterol?
Well, as you could tell, I haven't used this product yet. I've not prescribed it personally, and here we are recording this in April. I do use more of the combination inhaled steroid and formoterol, both as a controller, and I tell my patients if they need to use it extra, it's okay. So it is sort of as a rescue. But what I'd like to see, is it safer to use the shorter-acting beta agonist versus the longer beta agonist in combination with the inhaled steroid?
Yeah, Sean, what's your thoughts? I would imagine if they're bringing out this product to the market, what's going to be the relative price versus generic ICS-formoterol? I don't even know. We can only speculate. What's your thoughts on all this?
I think that's the big question. And I'm not sure if other people around the country have the same issue, but trying to get an ICS-LABA with formoterol sometimes is not on formulary. And so trying to be able to use these medications when the only option they're giving us is salmeterol, which we know is inappropriate to be used in as-needed basis, it's very difficult. But if this has that specific approval as a rescue inhaler, it may end up having better coverage. And so I'm excited to see more products that come into this space because I do think it brings some competition and hopefully allows more of our patients to have access to what the guidelines are actually recommending at this point, which unfortunately not all insurance companies have caught up with yet.
Yeah, I think that's the key thing, right? It's like access and the payers are like what's preventing implementation of guidelines right now. I mean, both sides of the street, the 2020 addendum and the GINA for at least a few years now. So, gosh, what is it going to take? If patients get admitted to the hospital, it has to be saving money if we're doing these therapies. At least that's my opinion. It should be a no-brainer.
You're right. My workaround is basically give them a short-acting beta agonist like albuterol and an inhaled steroid separate and just use it together. And I just tell moms to just use it together.
Yeah, I think it's easier in kids, but I think in adults, it's actually a little bit tricky when you tell them to carry around two inhalers. They're much less likely to do it versus if you're putting the responsibility on parents, I think they're much more likely to follow those recommendations.
But I do like, Stan, like you're giving options to parents who are concerned about inhaled steroids and you're giving them an option to give it more intermittently that still be effective. So I think parents do appreciate those choices for their children. Maybe this would be just making an easier way to align with how our patients want their asthma treated. So, okay, well, we're going to just cross our fingers and hopefully we'll have improved access to basically guideline recommended therapy. I mean, that's really what we're trying to do here. Let's go to the next article. Shyam, you got like a twofer on chronic rhinosinusitis with nasal polyposis. Actually, I have one after you, but why don't you get the ball rolling on that?
Absolutely. So yeah, I'm trying to be a little ambitious here. We're going to try to do two articles in the same amount of time. So a little bit higher level, but I think they work so well together. This first one we're going to talk about is an article from Clinical and Experimental Allergy in the December 2022 issue, which I commented on in one of the allergy watches that either just came out or is coming out very shortly. But it's titled Loss of Smell in Patients with Asthma Exacerbated Respiratory Disease Impacts Mental Health and Quality of Life. And a quick shout out to the Journal of Clinical and Experimental Allergy. In America, I don't think we put as much emphasis on this journal, but it is an excellent journal. It's put out by the British Society of Allergy and Clinical Immunology and really puts out some really great, very clinical appropriate studies. So quickly, background, this study is really looking at AERD patients, and we know that AERD affects about 0.3 to 0.9% of the general population, and about 7% of adults with asthma actually have AERD. The more you look for it, the more you're going to find it. And we also know that about over 90% of patients with AERD have some kind of smell and taste dysfunction, with 30% of those patients reporting this to be a really severe issue. While we don't know the exact etiology of the olfactory dysfunction, we know that it probably has more to do with the underlying inflammatory causes, increased levels of IL-2, IL-5, IL-13, more so than an actual physical obstruction that's caused by the polyps. And what this study did was it's out of Brigham and Women's, and they have 2,900 participants in their AERD registry, which just blows my mind. And they got about 29% of them to respond to the survey. And so that's about 850 patients. 73% of them were women, 91% were Caucasian. And what they did was they sent out seven surveys. And this included common surveys like SNOT-22 and ACT, but they also looked at quality of life surveys like the Healthy Days Core Module 4 and the Patient Health Questionnaire 4. And they also sent out some specific new questionnaires that they made specifically for the study. One was looking at the consequences of anosmia questionnaire and the severity of anosmia questionnaire that categorizes both smell and taste objectively. And what they found, as expected, about 85% of patients that have AERD are reporting smell and taste problems, 30% of them reporting this to be a very severe problem. And they broke this down further, and I think this is really where it gets interesting. There's a lot of data in this article, and I would recommend anybody taking a look at a lot of the figures and tables, but I just wanted to point out a few of the results, and this is going to tie in very nicely to the second study I'm talking about today. 86% of patients said they do not recognize spoiled food. 71% said they do not enjoy food or drinks at all anymore. 63% of them feel like they're unsafe because of the lack of smell and taste. And then even beyond that, 50% said personal hygiene concerns. 45% said they're just less happy. They feel more isolated. And 30% of people said this impacts their personal relationships. And looking at some of the other surveys, they showed about 1.5 times more unhealthy days in those patients that even had mild smell and taste dysfunction. You had significantly higher odds of having moderate to severe psychological distress with any form of smell or taste dysfunction. And the more dysfunction you had for your smell and taste, the more psychological distress that's reported. And so what's important here is just as allergists, we're taking care of these AERD patients. They may see ENT for the nasal polyp part of stuff. They may see pulmonary for some of the respiratory, but we really are the central core that ties this condition together. And it's really imperative that I think we acknowledge the effects of the lack of smell, the lack of taste in these patients' quality of life, how it affects them from day to day. And what we've started to do here at OHSU is we have a multidisciplinary clinic that we work with ENT on these AERD patients. And we actually regularly send out depression questionnaires, a PHQ-9, to really understand the level of depression that these patients are feeling, which I think, again, is just recognizing where this ends up as. So I'm going to go straight into the second article because it, again, ties in really nicely. And this one is by Anju Peters, and it is titled Improvement in Patient-Reported Taste in Association with Smell in Dupilumab-treated patients with chronic rhinosinusitis with nasal polyps from the Sinus 24 and Sinus 52 trials. Before I even go further, I do want to acknowledge that this article, research, and analysis was all funded by Regeneron and Sanofi. Important disclosure there. This was in, again, Clinical and Experimental Allergy in June 2022, so a few months before that article I just talked about. And knowing that these patients suffer from significant taste and smell dysfunction, this study looked back to, it was an ad hoc analysis of the Sinus 24 and Sinus 52 studies, which were the pivotal phase 3 trials to get dupilumab approved for CRS with nasal polyps. And a quick recap, that was a study that looked at 385 patients in the dupilumab group, 265 in the placebo group. And these patients had bilateral nasal polyps, were using intranasal steroids without significant improvement, had previously had surgery, or had needed systemic steroids in the past few years for their nasal polyps. And what they did was they looked at some of the surveys that they already had on hand, specifically this loss of taste severity categorical scale. Higher the number, the more dysfunction they have. Lower the number, the less dysfunction they have. And they also used some of the smell and taste questions from SNOT-22 and UPSET. And what they found was that there was an improvement of 0.94, which is quite significant, in the dupilumab group versus placebo. And they showed about 62% of the dupilumab group had an improvement of greater than 1. This is a scale of just 0 to 3. So an improvement of 1 is pretty significant here, 25% improvement, versus only 26% of the patients in placebo actually had that level of 1 improvement in that scale. And they maintained this throughout the whole study, so all 52 weeks in the Sinus 52 study. And obviously, there's some limitations here. This is a post-hoc analysis. This is a patient-reported scale and not an objective taste measurement. But what they did find also was that there wasn't a direct correlation between smell and taste improvement. And so there may be a separate mechanism at play here from dupilumab that also helps with maybe directly on the taste buds or something on the taste mechanism outside of just olfactory improvement. So yes, we need to recognize this. Biologics appear to be beneficial to helping both the olfactory and the taste dysfunction these patients face. And just to note that there are case reports and case series of patients on other biologics also having similar improvements in their taste and smell as well.
So Cheyenne, we've seen this in our patients, that they are dramatically improvement in their sense of smell and taste when we treat them with dupilumab for their nasal polyps, much better than if they just had them taken out, obviously. It's interesting you're suggesting that, well, maybe there is some kind of a different mechanism in the taste buds. I certainly have no idea, but it seems like the data does support what we're seeing in the clinic.
Yeah, and biologics aren't the end all and the only answer for patients that have AERD, but they are part of the pathway. And I think there's many other ways to treat these patients. But in the end, if one of their biggest concerns is the lack of smell, lack of taste, if they're not feeling well, if they're not feeling safe, there is data supporting the use of biologics now that really shows an improvement in those areas, not just obstruction or not just postnasal drip and actual other symptoms as well.
But I like your other take home about really screening for mental health consequences and addressing that. You're clearly making a strong argument about the impact that obviously we usually stick to the disease, but sometimes we could do a better job about looking at the extent. So that's a really great reminder for everybody. So I'm really glad that you brought that up. So I have another nasal polyp article. This is coming from a Northwestern group. The title of the article is Prognostic Factors for Polyp Recurrence in Chronic Rhinosinusitis with Nasal Polyps. The senior author was Bhutan. I reviewed it for Allergy Watch. And this is looking at recurrence, and we see it all the time. For a lot of patients, nasal polyps are relentless. They're relentless and obviously is leading to a lot of the mental health consequences we were talking about. Some of the statistics that's quoted in the intro of this article is that the frequency of polyp recurrence is as high as 40% in 18 months and 62% over 10 years. And so therefore, you almost expect it. But we have to recognize that's not 100%. So there's certainly going to be subgroups of chronic rhinosinusitis with nasal polyps. And it would be nice to know who needs aggressive therapy, as we're suggesting, like biologic therapy or so on, and those who could maybe get watchful waiting after their endoscopic surgery, for example. So I think that that's what these investigators attempted to do. They were able to recruit 94 patients who underwent endoscopic sinus surgery, and then they were able to do biomarker analysis of the homogenates. And so they can get real interesting information about the nature of their polyps and see if it ties into recurrence. And so some of the things they looked at were, they looked at cytokines, obviously T2 cytokines and non-T2 cytokines. They looked at eosinophilic proteins like eosinophilic cationic protein. But this is the most interesting one, and I really want to get back to this later, and that they looked at anti-double-stranded DNA. And the reason that this is very intriguing to me is that we've always wondered why a subset of patients with chronic rhinosinusitis and nasal polyps have adult onset without allergy, but strong T2 inflammation. And sure, you're saying, like, what's driving the inflammation? And you talk to certain experts, and they say this adult onset presentation sort of smells autoimmune. We do know about these sort of acquired conditions that happen later in life. At least it sort of follows the natural history of something that you weren't born with, like something that obtained later, not our traditional environmental allergies that you get when you're in childhood. So moving forward, essentially, this was a group where about 22% had ARD, about 58% of them had asthma, about half of them, this was their first surgery. About the other half, about 46% had a revision. And essentially, they are looking at the correlations between biomarkers and recurrence. And based on the analysis, they were actually able to develop a prediction model based not only on clinical characteristics, but also tissue biomarkers. So this is going to be your top five. So the top five things they use in the prediction model is, number one, the pre-surgical radiography score, the MLM. Number two, asthma. And then there's three biomarkers they found interesting. One, eosinophilic cationic protein. Number two, interleukin-5. But three, and this is the one I wanted to talk about, was anti-double-stranded DNA IgG. It did correlate with recurrence. So clearly, one of the goals of the study is that now can we potentially routinely test patients, their nasal polyp homogenates, and correlate with clinical characteristics, and then give them a prognosis. And then maybe patients who are likely to have recurrence, maybe we are going to be a little bit more aggressive in these therapies to prevent recurrence versus the ones, okay, let's see what happens. You have some nice prognostic indicators. But the number two thing, and again, I'm going to bring it again, is that this is sort of further evidence, like looking into the reason why. Why do these patients apparently without allergies have adult onset nasal polyps? And I think I'm just looking for more studies that sort of explore the autoimmune hypothesis. It's just very interesting to me. I'm not sure if I really fully understand either, but like these are some of the studies that come out that sort of look at this. So again, I thought it was very interesting, and hopefully we'll be able to utilize this for our patients.
Yeah, I think the eosinophil cation protein, IL-5, asthma, they all make sense, especially this is really painting that Th2, the AERD type patient, which we know the polyp recurrence is very high. But I agree with you. This double-stranded DNA is interesting. This actually parallels well with chronic spontaneous urticaria. So many years ago, there was this autoimmune hypothesis. People were not quite sure about it. And I would say over the past decade, there's mounting evidence now that this is probably some form of autoimmune condition. We're just not exactly sure what the pathogenic autoantibody is or autoreactive T cell is yet. But I think this does point us in that direction that hopefully eventually we'll get some clarity on this.
You know, the whole concept of personalized medicine is something on the forefront right now. And this is an example of what potentially could result in more personalized approach to treatment, which is what we all are striving for.
Well, I thought these articles were really interesting. If you really liked what you heard today, please rate our podcast on iTunes. And also, we do want to hear from you. If you have any feedback, corrections, suggestions for a future episode, our email address is allergytalk1word@acaai.org. Just as a reminder, we do offer CME credit. To learn more about that, again, the website is college.acaai.org/publications/allergywatch. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll catch you next time. Enjoy the rest of your day. The ACAAI is presenting this podcast for educational purposes only. It is not medical advice, nor is it intended to replace the judgment of a licensed physician. The college is not responsible for any claims related to the procedures, professionals, products, or methods discussed in the podcast, and it does not approve or endorse any products, professionals, services, or methods that may be referenced. Today's speakers have the following disclosures. Dr. Lee has nothing to disclose. Dr. Joshi has been an advisory board member for Takeda, Leo Pharma, Sanofi Regeneron, Nectar Algae, and Cogen, and has had clinical trial funding from GlaxoSmithKline and Sanofi. Dr. Feynman has been a speaker for Takeda and has done research for AI Immune, DBV, and BioCryst.